Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your host, Eric Mike Sterino, coming to you today from a freezing Asheville, North Carolina, which I absolutely hate. I hate the cold, but I have a very warm feeling in my heart because today it's a complete episode, and I have the wonderful Juliet Liu, who is here co-hosting with me today. Juliet, how's it going out there in Berkeley?
Hey, it's not much warmer. I mean, for Berkeley, it isn't, but we're doing well.
As a quick reminder, if you want to follow the latest news, research, and discussions revolving around the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. As we seemingly talk about in every episode, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative has certainly had profound effects in the realm of international relations and political science discourse. For me especially, it's very important in the realm of rhetoric, propaganda, imagined communities. But much of the commonly noted actions in which are tied to the Belt and Road Initiative itself, that is the continued use of Chinese state and state commercial financing for state-owned enterprises to build out infrastructure and energy projects throughout Belt and Road countries, has of course been happening well before the Belt and Road's announcement in November 2013. What is interesting now, you know, we're in 2020, we've had about 6 years since the official launch of the Belt and Road Initiative, we can start to now see differences, if there are any, that have come out of China since the popularization of the Belt and Road as a concept and different policies which have been labeled under the Belt and Road Initiative for specific sectors. That's why I was really thrilled when I came across this new paper published in January 2020, copy from Australia National University's The China Journal, entitled The Unintended Consequences of Politicization of the Belt and Road's China-Europe Freight Train Initiative. It's an exciting article by Dr. Linda Jia Yinor that looks at the historical political economic drivers that led to the creation of the China-Europe Freight Rail and how the advent of the Belt and Road Initiative has changed the dynamics of the project. Dr. Linda Jia Yinor is an assistant professor at the Department of Asian International Studies at City University in Hong Kong, and we are so happy for her to join us today. Linda, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Hi, Eric. Glad to be here.
So first, can you give our listeners a little bit about your research background and why this places you in a unique position to study the China-Europe Railway?
Sure. Long before I start this research project, I work at the Kowloon Canton Railway Corporations in Hong Kong. Before I actually study my PhD program at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. And because of that working experience, I have established very good connections with the mainland railway cadres. We have run railway through trains between Hong Kong and Beijing, Shanghai and Guangzhou. So I have made good friends in the railway sector in China. And that actually made me very interested in knowing how the railway sector in China has been undergoing various type of reform. And then after working at the Kowloon Canton Railway Corporations for a couple of years, I decided to enroll in a PhD program at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. And then my research at that point of time focused on domestic railway reform in China. And after I complete the various fieldwork in China, talking to a number of railway cadres in Beijing, Shanghai, Chongqing, Wuhan, Guangzhou, etc. I eventually published a book under Rawlidge, which is about China's railway reform domestically. And after that, I decided to continue to work on the railway sector, but took a different step to look at how various subordinate institutes under the railway regimes has been spin off out of the railway sector and entering into various other related business. And one of the important topic would be the China-Europe freight trains. That is the reason I started to research on this Belt and Road project. And that is also the reasons why I have been able to contact with various railway cadres that are involved in this interesting yet very understudied sector.
Yeah, and that's wonderful. And it really came through in the paper. So much of the best research, or at least the research I really can gravitate towards, are those who really have an understanding of the domestic political economy within China and how that influences the Belt and Road. And so it was really wonderful. So one of the most fascinating aspects within your paper was the detailing of the original idea for such a railway that actually stemmed from this local Chinese government entrepreneurialism and Western multinational capital. Can you contextualize the pre-Belt and Road Initiative formation of the China-European Railway?
Yeah, a lot of the people have seen this China-Europe freight trains as a kind of advertising campaign for the Belt and Road. But actually, only a number of them actually were operated for a number of years well before Xi Jinping announced the Belt and Road. So the idea of this freight transport between Asia and Europe, making use of the Eurasian land bridge, actually has been arising for many years at multiple sites. And we can actually date back to some of the initiative in 1914, before the World War I, when people were making use of the Eurasian land bridge for military transport. And later on, it has been transformed into other commercial cargo transport. So therefore, it was not something new after the Belt and Road Initiative in China. And then among all these commercial initiatives, around 2008, the Chongqing government in China, which was led by the deputy mayor at that point of time, Huang Qifan, he actually wanted to diversify Chongqing's economic activities into a electronic manufacturing base, because you know that Chongqing was one of the inland place in China which has suffered from income inequality, especially if you compare to coastal regions, for a long period of time. So the Chongqing government was very keen on trying to diversify their economic activities. And given Chongqing's strategic locations in this Eurasian land bridge, Chongqing can actually position itself as the starting point of this land bridge. So Huang Qifan actually took the initiative and act as a broker. He visited HP's headquarters in California, asking the company to move the manufacturing base of its laptop manufacturing factory all the way from along the coastal region in China to Chongqing. So HP had invested in like Shanghai, Jiangsu, Fujian, Guangdong, for example, because of its convenient coastal location where the company actually can save the shipping costs of parts to China and final products to other worldwide destinations. When Chongqing government came to visit HP and asked them to move their manufacturing base to Chongqing, and Huang Qifan at that point of time promised a few thing that makes HP actually very keen on taking Chongqing's offer. First, Chongqing's land and labor costs would be a lot lower than the coastal area. And second, the seaborne freight services have actually increased the lead time around that point of time from 25 days to more than 35 days because the sea transport want to save the fuel cost. So they slow down the engine and therefore they move slower. The result of that is that it would take longer time for HP's computer to arrive at the destination. So this has been HP for a long time. They want to solve this kind of transport lead time. And the third thing that Huang Qifan promised is to arrange a vertically integrated value chain for notebook production in Chongqing. Don't forget that HP originally invests in the coastal area for its convenient locations where they can receive the parts from overseas at a very low cost and convenient manner. When they agree to move their base to Chongqing, then it means that they will have to not only get the parts from overseas, but they will also have to take care of the parts from the coastal ports to the inland factory. And what Huang Qifan promised is that they will take care of that. they will also ask the OEM factory, which is the Taiwan's Foxconn, to also move to Chongqing. So in that way, they promise a vertically integrated value chain for HP. So HP would be very happy because they don't need to worry about the transportations of the part. So Chongqing government actually solved the supply problems for HP. And lastly, and which is the most important thing, is that the Chongqing government agreed to subsidize the railway delivery cost, which normally is twice as much as the sea transport. And therefore, HP will pay nothing more than when they situate their manufacturing factory in the coastal area and yet get their laptop transport to European cities in almost half of the original days. So therefore, HP was very happy to accept the offer and eventually moved their factory to Chongqing. So not only HP, but also Foxconn moved there, and then a lot of other different multinational corporations seeing this kind of arrangement also are very happy to move to the IT zone in Chongqing. And Chongqing then has been able to attract foreign investment, increase the local tax income, and also have more employment opportunities for its people. So therefore, although Chongqing government subsidized the transport costs, the government actually received a lot more the money that they has been spent on the subsidies. This is the first train, the China-Europe first train, that was commenced service in July of 2011. And after this model, this is very much a local statecraft model. After this Chongqing model, Chengdu also follow. And therefore, they also trying to attract similar multinational investment in Chengdu and offering all these kind of subsidies for their products to transport all the way from Chengdu to the European countries. So these two very first freight trains initiative were, I would say, commercially oriented. I mean, it made a lot of economic sense. It's not a pure political project, but it is an economic project that has happened well before the Belt and Road Initiative.
So just zooming out a little bit, I was wondering if you could walk us through, there's so many different countries that this China-Europe freight project passes through. And you write that, it's different from ocean freight. Rail freight involves many operators across a considerable number of countries. And so there's especially complex geopolitical implications in terms of improving freight links along this route that touches so many different countries. Can you sketch out the key implications for us a bit?
Sure. The first China-Europe blockchain services was dedicated to move HP's notebook computers, and the service was commenced in July 2011, which took 16 days from Chongqing to Duisburg in Germany through the Alasanko in Congo's dry port, where goods have to be unloaded from trains on China side and loaded to trains on the Kazakhstan side because of the different rail track width between the two countries. And then the freight trains will continue to move across Kazakhstan, Russia, Belarus, Poland, and finally reach Germany. So there are a number of countries that the trains actually crossed when they have to travel from Chongqing to Europe, to Germany. Different from ocean freight, rail freight inevitably involves a transnational aspect because it means that you have to cross the boundary of each country. And that renders the organization of rail cargo a huge challenge. Railway sector, it's like a railway kingdom. In China, railway cadres always call themselves Iron Brothers, 铁大哥. And I think it's actually the same for every country because usually the railway operators along this China-Europe freight route are state-owned or state-operated, and they often see themselves as a group of powerful gatekeepers. And therefore, they're usually less customer-friendly as compared to the market-oriented shipping sector. It therefore required a lot of effort to coordinate a seamless border crossing formalities, which involves, for example, train path scheduling, security checking, customs clearance, and also unified tracking standards that are very important for goods to move along this rail route. And in 2017, actually, the first China Rail Express working group meeting was convened among China, Belarus, Germany, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Poland, and Russia. And they also realized that they need to sign a cooperation agreement in order to deepen the development of this service. So the geopolitical implication is very different from if people just transport their goods on the ship that only require coordination at the two ends, rather than you have to organize everything along the route.
So does a say a train gets loaded up in Chongqing, then it has to actually go through customs when it goes past Xinjiang into Kazakhstan and so on and so forth. For each country, it has to go through a separate customs system, or is the point of their negotiations to reduce those customs tracking?
At the beginning, before this 2011 first China-Europe freight train, I think they will have to have each custom clearance and checking at every point of and every checkpoint when they cross the boundary. And I think in 2011, both Chongqing government and HP together, they went to each and every checkpoint and explained to them why they need this seamless movement. And therefore, they resolve a lot of the formalities so that they don't need to do it at every checkpoint. They actually have this group meeting, joint meeting, in order to smooth out all the formalities.
Yeah, and I'm curious, you know, all these steps that are involved, who was or who is the Chinese company that's involved? How and who did they cooperate with in their fellow countries? Typically, the railroad sector tends to be very state-dominated. And thirdly, how much of this was new track that was being built and developed, and how much was either retrofitted old track and lanes that had been existed that were just being connected more seamlessly?
I think I'll answer the second question first, which is easier and straightforward, that they basically make use of the existing rail track. They have not construct new rail tracks just for the China-Europe freight train. So they're using the existing route. Therefore, this is not really about constructions, infrastructure projects along the Belt and Road. This is only about using the existing rail tracks and moving goods on the track.
Really? So what's noted as like the China-Europe freight rail, which is this big Belt and Road project, there was no new building that happened?
There was no new rail tracks at the moment. They want to upgrade it because, as I mentioned, they will have to unload and load the goods across Xinjiang and Kazakhstan because of the different rail track width. The width is different. They will have to use a different train, basically. It's the goods that will have to just unload from the China side and then load on the other side so that they will then make use of the trains in Kazakhstan and then continue the journey. But then there are some new building. For example, this whole system to load and unload, it's located in Kongos, which is a new dry port there. And Kazakhstan is aimed to turn it into a world-class Dubai-like dry port. So then therefore, China actually helped to build this dry port, and they also built a new town next to this dry port, anticipating a lot of people will come here, live there, and work for the dry port. So there are a bit of new building in terms of facilitating the China-Europe freight train. In terms of who they contact on this China-Europe freight trains in order to facilitate the seamless movement of goods from China to Europe, basically the key agents are the railway operators. Of course, they also have to contact customs, immigration, security officials, and people who have to decide on the tariff for goods entering and going out of each and every countries. So there are a lot of officials involved in this whole project. And in terms of the key unit who trying to connect each and every part of this project would be the freight forwarder in China. So there is one freight forwarder, for example, the Chongqing Europe Freight Trains Company. They call it Yuxingo, which is they make use of the name of each cities, and it is the Chongqing Xinjiang Europe Freight Trains Companies. And this freight forwarder will take the order from the clients and then make sure that they will resolve every problems along the Belt and Road, well, basically along the freight train route, and deliver the goods to the destinations, which is the Duisburg in Germany.
Huh, really interesting. What's the current status in 2019 or whatever the latest data is of how many trains are going between China and Europe now?
There is actually no official update on the number of trains. The latest figures that I can get from Chinese National Development and Reform Commission is a figure that is up to 2017, in which they said that there are actually around 2,400 westbound trains and around 1,270 eastbound trains connecting Chinese cities and European cities.
Huh. So it's safe to say there's a lot more going out of China than there is things coming into China.
Exactly. That is actually the problem, because a lot of the return trains are empty, and that increased the transport costs.
Huh. And one thing, and it was one of the main points in the article, and we alluded to a little bit before when you talked about how the original concept and idea of the China-Europe freight train was this interlocking between Chongqing entrepreneurialism or Southwest Chinese officials entrepreneurialism and also Western multinational needs in terms of shipping into a European market. But that was based upon first, in one example of Chongqing, the utilization of subsidies in order to track the HP and Foxconn. But then after the Belt and Road Initiative came as well, there was also different types of subsidies that came in. And so I want to think about the political landscape and how Belt and Road projects are funded and supported. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of subsidies and how they're utilized within the China-Europe Railway pre-Belt and Road and then after the Belt and Road Initiative?
The subsidies is very tricky. Everyone knows there is subsidies for China-Europe freight trains, because otherwise no one will start to use these services. The China-Europe freight train is famous for one official slogan that it is faster than sea transport, but cheaper than air. And therefore, they have to make it cheaper. In reality, they have to make it cheaper not only than air transport, but also cheaper than sea, or at least comparable to sea transport. And we all know that it is impossible. So if you ask if any railway operators, they can tell you that it's impossible. The cost is simply much more than running a vessel all the way from China to Europe. And why would they be able to attract shippers to use the train services in the first place? Is definitely because of subsidies. But then, because this is something that everyone know, yet everyone don't really want to disclose the real amount of subsidies. So therefore, I have to ask informally about the scale of the subsidies and how they use it and how they pay. But actually, no one can answer that question. Therefore, we don't know how they distribute the subsidies along this rail route. All we know is that from different sources, the subsidies range between 40 to 60% of the real cost. There are a number of outliers. I know that Yiwu, the train starting from Yiwu to Poland actually received no subsidies because it is a very market-oriented business. But then other freight trains actually, I have heard from some of my informants that the subsidies is as high as 100%. So it is actually free to move goods. It's amazing. The problem is that these subsidies, these large amounts of subsidies, especially for those freight train companies that start to operate China-Europe freight trains after Chongqing and Chengdu, and after Xi Jinping announced this Belt and Road Initiative, then they actually do this basically for political support or for political reasons, that they want to show that they are responding to Xi Jinping's idea. And then they just operate freight trains once a week or even once a month, just as a gesture of being politically correct. And also, running China-Europe freight trains is the most cost-effective, even if you subsidize 100% of the transport cost for once a month. Because then, once you have the freight trains moving between your own cities and a European cities, then usually the first train will attract a lot of media coverage. And then you can have a very fantastic report on your political work. And therefore, every local government rushed to operate these China freight trains with high percentage of subsidies, because then they want to make the whole train loaded with goods. And they don't care, because this is just one off or once a month, and it is actually not a lot compared to their political kind of reward based on operate this freight trains. And the problem is then it affects the movement of goods in a very unhealthy way, because then goods sometimes actually go backward. For example, I've heard from my informants that goods from Xinjiang actually were transported from Xinjiang back to somewhere inland and then reroute to Europe just because they have the subsidies, and they just move backward for free, and then they reroute to Europe for no economic reasons.
You know, you said some of them are maybe once every other week, some of them are once a month. How standardized have these different China to Europe freight trains become? If I was a manufacturer in Southwest China, would it be easy for my goods to get onto these routes? Or has it become just very political where it's not even much of a market for this type of freight train shipment?
How standard? Well, after Xi Jinping announced his Belt and Road Initiative, they actually unified the brand name. Originally, freight services were named according to the cities of origin and destination. And later on, Xi Jinping and the Chinese government announced that they want to unify the brand name and call it China Europe Freight Trains. And it was expected to under the control of China Railway Transport Corporations. But then actually, if you ask individual freight train services operators, the government actually provide no guidelines. So they just take it as a signature project of its Belt and Road Initiative for the fact that it has been there, and therefore it required no extra effort before they really see things going on. So it's actually a very common strategy for Chinese government to re-centralize, what I will call that. They initially have no plan, and then they see things going on, and then they recognize this is actually a good project for them to brand it as a Belt and Road Initiative, and then they re-centralize the idea. Yet they don't provide a lot of guidelines, and therefore you see a lot of unhealthy competitions and unhealthy organization of China-Europe freight trains.
And so you would argue that this re-centralization of this prior regional project has brought irrational economic incentives, as in the past, even though there was subsidies involved, it had a greater political economic development mechanism for Chongqing because of the tax revenue and increased exports, so on.
Yes. So the subsidies before the Belt and Road Initiative make sense, because it actually brings a lot of employment, a lot of investment, a lot of other revenue to the local government who offers subsidies. It also helped actually connect with the European cities. But then after the Chinese government re-centralized the project, it becomes a political project. The politicization actually undermined the economic reasons. Although they are all about subsidies, so therefore a lot of people would then think it is bad because of the fact that it is subsidized. But in fact, it is not bad for every freight train. They are actually different. They have different imperative behind.
You had one interesting quote in your article from Jonathan Hillman from the Center for Strategic and International Studies that said, influence will flow along these new transportation lines. There's, of course, a broad assumption that Chinese construction, or I guess management of this infrastructure, extends Chinese influence. But how does this train, the China-Europe train, specifically relate to influence or to connectivity diplomacy?
In my fieldwork along these freight trains, especially in Kazakhstan that I went to last summer, one of the key immediate influence is what I have mentioned as a kind of influence on the trading and trading-related activities. When I visited Kazakhstan, I actually met a representative of the Wuhan Europe Free Trade Company there. And the representative was actually a Russian young girl who speaks and types perfect Chinese. And you can see, I mean, very interesting talking to this young girl, because when we communicate before I arrive at Kazakhstan, we communicate with WeChat. She typed perfect Chinese. I thought she was a Chinese. But then when I arrived there, I recognized she was a Russian girl that speaks perfect Mandarin. And you can see that actually the Chinese freight train company trying to appoint or employ local Russian-speaking youngsters to help them to develop the business. So first of all, the influence would be they create a little bit more of the employment opportunities, and there are a kind of cultural interactions, because then if you interact with this Russian girl, you can feel that she acts a lot more like Chinese, like she will come and have dinner and lunch with me, she will took me out and see interesting thing in Kazakhstan, in Almaty. It won't happen for local Kazakhstani. So this girl is very much accommodate to Chinese way of doing business. And this is the first kind of influence in the cultural and soft way. And the other way is that I mentioned before, one of the problem of this China-Europe freight chain is the empty return train. So the freight forwarder will have to absorb the cost of running empty return train back to China. Although then this also explains why they will receive subsidies from local government. Yes, they also want to work on this empty return train in order to survive even without local government subsidies, because that part is not going to be there forever. So if it stops subsidizing the freight chains, they still want to make sure that it is sustainable. And what they have been doing now is that they are now not only a logistics practitioners, but they also become a traders. So they will employ a local agents there, getting a lot of different goods to ship them to China, and then they will make use of their trains. So for example, when I was there, I see this Russian young girl working for Wuhan Europe Freight Chains, trying to negotiate for a business with a local grape seed oil producers in Kazakhstan. And they were trying to buy these edible oils and then ship them to Wuhan for sale. And so then they actually expand their business from running a train or operating a logistics service to actually involve in trading themselves. And there are a lot of other trading related activities going on, because Kazakhstan is famous for oil, but it is not edible oil. Therefore, they will have to develop, or they will have to establish a laboratory which can test the standard of the edible oil that has to be transported to China, because China has their own standard of all this food, including oil, chilled meat, wine, dairy products, etc. So you can see that this is the immediate influence on the China-Europe freight train in Kazakhstan.
Huh. So now Wuhan state-owned freight train company is in the oil seed trading business in Kazakhstan?
Yeah, yes. This is only part of their business. They're trying to develop a lot of other trade business.
Well, that from every other state-owned enterprise I've ever come across, the ones I'm most familiar with, you know, they would talk about how they had 10 departments 20 years ago, and now they'll have 130 different departments because they'll move into any type of business that they can fluctuate and utilize their access to privileged capital to. So,
Exactly.
Interesting. Linda, will you stay around for recommendations?
Yeah, sure.
Great. You've been listening to the Belt and Road Podcast. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. And please check out Linda's article, The Unintended Consequences of Politicization of Belt and Road, China-Europe Freight Train Initiative. It's a must read. Put it in the show notes. It's in the China Journal from Australia National University. Juliet, do you got any recommendations for us today?
I do. So I've started looking into Central Asia kind of politics recently and got recommended a book that I haven't fully read yet. I've just started the introduction, but it's called Great Games, Local Rules, The New Great Power Conflict contest in Central Asia. It's by Alex Cooley. And for those who don't know, which I didn't know before I started reading this, the original Great Game was in the 19th century, the struggle between the British Empire and Russia over kind of influence in Central Asia. But this book, Great Games, Local Rules, it focuses on the growing tensions between the U.S., China, and Russia over influence in Central Asia. And it foregrounds how Central Asian states have been able to kind of use the competition of those three powers in order to position themselves to extract benefits out of those growing tensions between the U.S., China, and Russia. It's great so far and very topical for the research that Linda does. So I wanted to recommend that myself. And Linda, do you have something to recommend as well?
I would like to recommend an earlier book that was written by Brantley Womack and his idea of asymmetric relations between China and a weaker nations actually inspire my understanding on how Kazakhstan react to China's grand policy of Belt and Road Initiative. And this is a book published with Cambridge University Press and entitled as Asymmetry and International Relations. Basically, the idea was that a strong and weak nations actually will find a way to interact with each other so that they would survive in a way that we basically will not be able to think if we are not looking at the relations with this asymmetry framework. And in my study of Kazakhstan's relations with China, I see nowadays that Kazakhstan has a lot of leverage because of the fact that it is connecting with China and China wants so much to connect to the European cities via Kazakhstan. So I think this is a fantastic book in terms of having a great theoretical framework to look at the empirical development.
Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful book. I'll certainly have to check that out. For my recommendations today, I have two slightly obscure ones, but first is not so much a recommendation and more of a shout out to Keith Bradshaw, who is the Shanghai bureau chief for the New York Times. Last week, he wrote an article about the Belt and Road called China Renews Its Belt and Road Push for Global Sway. Most part, it was a decent article, just more mainstream article updating about Belt and Road's prominence last year. But there's one particular line that he used when he was talking about, you know, the negative aspects that can come about from the Belt and Road Initiative. And he wrote, the contracts are mostly for construction and equipment by big Chinese companies using Chinese skilled labor and loans from Chinese banks, although the projects often create jobs for local laborers as well. This was the first time I've ever really read a more mainstream overview of the Belt and Road Initiative that actually specified between Chinese skilled labor and Chinese labor. You usually just say, oh, they bring in Chinese labor, which has been disproven over and over again. I think this is a much better way of framing the discussion. And any other journalists out there who wants to write something about the Belt and Road, a major think piece, this is a great way of standardizing the language. Secondly, I've been trying to, from North Carolina, keep up with my Chinese language abilities. And I'd heard about this website for 10 years now, Douban, which is widely used in China, but I hadn't been on it for a long time. It's really matured since when I first went on it, which was kind of like a Chinese IMDb, but it's much more a Chinese, it's like a Quora that mixes with a social media feed that mixes with rather elevated discussion about art and movies and design and those types of issues. So you can find much more interesting and engaging, at least for me, issues and things to read about than the standard People's Daily or what have you, or even Weibo. So just browsing around Douban. Linda, thank you so much for joining us again on the Belt and Road podcast.